Welcome to Counter Apologetics.
Welcome to Counter Apologetics. I'm your host, Emerson Green, and today we'll be discussing the Easter story. Hundreds of millions of people in modern societies will gather to celebrate human sacrifice next week. And as bizarre as it may seem, acknowledging this is a bit of a taboo. I know it's not a mystery to any of you, but the social institution of religion is how an absurdity like the celebration of a human sacrifice and punishment of those who don't celebrate it gets smuggled into the 21st century. More on that later, but first we should talk about the details of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, since the Easter story is the central pillar of Christian theism.
Justification can Christians offer in contrast to Hindus, Jews, or Muslims for thinking that the Christian God is real? Well, the answer of the New Testament to that question is clear: the resurrection of Jesus. The resurrection is God's vindication of Jesus' radical personal claims to divine authority.
If the apologetics that specifically support Christianity don't hold water, the reasons you're left with for believing are things like the cosmological argument, the fine-tuning argument, the moral argument, etc. The problem, if you accept those arguments, is that Allah or Thor or any other god could just as easily have been the cause of the Big Bang, the fine-tuner of the universe, or the standard for objective morality. The traditional Jesus story based on the Gospels is the main thing that your specific god is based on, and that's why the weakness of Easter apologetics is so striking. The popularity of apologetics like the fine-tuning argument or the moral argument far exceeds anything related to Jesus. If you're a Christian, defending the Easter story is really important, and every apologist tries to do it, but the amount of energy that goes into the Kalam cosmological argument seems to be much greater than the energy that goes into smoothing over the stark contradictions in the crucifixion and resurrection. And I think it's honestly just because it's harder to argue for Christian theism than a less specific God. But that being said, let's listen to William Lane Craig give three reasons to accept the resurrection of Jesus.
Now, Dr. Atkins says, "I know of no evidence that the resurrection did take place. But there are actually three established facts recognized by the majority of New Testament historians today, which I believe are best explained by the resurrection of Jesus. Fact number one, on the Sunday following his crucifixion, Jesus' tomb was discovered empty by a group of his women followers. Fact number two, on separate occasions, different individuals and groups saw appearances of Jesus alive after his death. According to the prominent New Testament critic of Vanderbilt University, Gout Ludemann, it may be taken as historically certain that the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ. These appearances were witnessed not only by believers, but also by unbelievers, skeptics, and even enemies. Fact number three, the original disciples suddenly came to believe in the resurrection of Jesus despite having every predisposition to the contrary."
That someone rose from the dead is the best explanation here? There are several other explanations that don't invoke magic at all. For one, someone could have removed the body. I don't see how a literal resurrection is more plausible than someone just removing the body. And as we'll talk about later, it's possible that Jesus was never buried in a tomb in the first place. It's also possible that since our records of this event were written decades after the occurrence, and the specific copies we have were written centuries after the events, that not every detail was perfectly preserved when it was being passed around orally for decades before being written down. We don't actually know that the disciples saw Jesus after his death, or that the disciples believed in his resurrection. We have reports that they saw him and believed in the resurrection, and these reports are deeply flawed. The early stories about Jesus were disseminated orally. Not everyone had access to the original story. Some people were repeating descriptions of the accounts from someone else who may have heard the original. But most people hearing the stories were hearing them from people who had heard the stories from people who had heard the stories from people who told the original. And this went on for decades and decades before anyone wrote these accounts down. And we don't even have those accounts. We have copies of those accounts. If this were any other story, we wouldn't even think twice about taking it seriously. The fact is, we just don't know what the eyewitnesses believed. But even if we did, it's possible for people to be mistaken. And we're not even talking about people with a modern understanding of the world. Even if we ignore everything I just said and believe William Lane Craig that the disciples definitely saw Jesus after his death, he's claiming that the best evidence for the claim that a dead body came back to life is that a handful of primitive, superstitious desert dwellers from thousands of years ago probably sincerely thought it was true. We should take a minute to address the claim that the Gospels were written by eyewitnesses or are based on eyewitness accounts. So, according to the historical evidence, even though there may have been eyewitnesses alive a few decades after Jesus' death, there's no reason to think that any of them were consulted by the authors of the Gospels. The Gospels are based on oral traditions that had been in circulation in different countries, told in different languages, among non-eyewitnesses for decades before the Gospel writers had ever heard them. The eyewitnesses would have been Aramaic-speaking peasants almost entirely from Galilee. The author of Mark was a highly educated Greek-speaking Christian living in a completely different area. The later Gospels were even less directly influenced by eyewitnesses. The author of Luke, at the beginning of his Gospel, states that eyewitnesses started passing along oral traditions that he had eventually heard, but he never says that he had ever talked to an eyewitness. The original copies of Matthew and Luke were written about 50 years or more after Jesus' death, and the original Gospel of John was even later. Another interesting bit of information is that the Gospel authors are anonymous. They're traditionally attributed to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but that's just a tradition. We actually have no idea who wrote those books. So the Gospel authors are anonymous, non-eyewitnesses. In his book, How Jesus Became God, Bart Ehrman writes of the Gospels, quote, "Even apart from the fact that they were written 40 to 65 years after the facts, by people who were not there to see these things happen, who were living in different parts of the world, at different times, and speaking different languages, apart from all this, they are filled with discrepancies, some of which cannot be reconciled. In fact, the Gospels disagree on nearly every detail in the resurrection narratives. Who was the first person to go to the tomb? Was it Mary Magdalene by herself, as it says in John, or Mary along with another woman, as it says in Matthew? Or Mary along with multiple other women, as it says in Luke? Was the stone already rolled away or not when they arrived at the tomb? Did they see an angel there, as it says in Matthew, or a man, as it says in Mark, or two men, as it says in Luke? Did the women then go tell the disciples, as it says in Matthew and Luke, or not, as it says in Mark? Did the disciples see Jesus, as it says in Matthew and Luke, or not, as it says in Mark? If they did they see him in Galilee, as it says in Matthew, or only in Jerusalem, as it says in Luke?" End quote. And on the contradictions go. In Mark, it explicitly states that Jesus died after the Passover meal. In John, it says that he died before the Passover. In Luke, the curtain was torn before Jesus died, and in Matthew and Mark, it was torn after he died. Jesus also has three different sets of dying last words in the Gospels. I've been referencing Bart Ehrman, and I will again a few more times. In case you don't know who he's an agnostic historian and a New Testament scholar. He writes college textbooks, and he's currently a professor of religious studies at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and I'll have a lot of his work in the show notes. Christians will often use an analogy in response to the claim that the Gospels contradict each other on these points and others. They say, imagine several people saw a car accident and they had to report what they saw to the police. The reports would sound different. Different parts would be emphasized. There may be details in one account but not another. Different witnesses will notice different things and are coming to the table with different points of view, so you'd expect the Gospels not to sound exactly the same. The problem with this is that while not every difference between the accounts are contradictions, some of them are. As you've probably noticed, some of the details in the different accounts are mutually incompatible. There just is no way to square them. It's commonly claimed that there were 500 eyewitnesses to the resurrection, and this is based on 1 Corinthians 15:6. Quote, "After that, Jesus appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters." End quote. We do not have 500 independent eyewitnesses of Jesus' resurrection. What we have is one source, Paul, who claims that 500 people were eyewitnesses. But in fact, we don't even have that. We have copies of copies of copies of a manuscript that was originally written decades after the supposed events, where one man, who is not an eyewitness and doesn't claim to be, says that 500 people witnessed a resurrection 2,000 years ago. If you state the evidence in generic terms, it's not exactly compelling. But if for some reason you accept this evidence, in order to be consistent, you may have to bite the bullet on other miracle claims. If you accept the miracle of the resurrection based on the evidence that I just stated, you have to also accept other miracle claims that either meet or exceed that standard of evidence. Miracle claims from other religions get over the low bar that you've set, but so do claims of alien abductions and Elvis sightings.
Even if we had multiple contemporaneous claims of the miracles of Jesus, this would not be good enough. Because miracle stories abound even in the 21st century. The devotees of the South Indian guru Satya Sai Baba ascribe all of the miracles of Jesus to him. He reads minds, he foretells the future, he raises the dead, he was born of a virgin. Okay, Satya Sai Baba is not a fringe figure. You might not have heard of him, but they had a birthday party for him a few years ago, and 1 million people showed up. There are vast numbers of people who think he's a living God. Okay, so Christianity is predicated on the claim that miracle stories, exactly of the kind that today surround a person like Satya Sai Baba, become especially credible when you place them in the pre-scientific religious context of the first century Roman Empire, decades after their supposed occurrence, as attested to by copies of copies of copies of ancient Greek and largely discrepant manuscripts. We have Satya Sai Baba's miracle stories attested to by thousands upon thousands of living eyewitnesses, and they don't even merit an hour on cable television. And yet you put a few miracle stories in an ancient book, and half the people on earth think it a legitimate project to organize their lives around them.
Let's assume that Jesus was resurrected. The evidence for the resurrection is not compelling, especially when you remove the proper nouns, but let's just grant the whole resurrection for the sake of argument. What exactly does this prove? Even if a man was executed by the Roman government and came back to life, why does that mean that everything he ever said was true? If I ask you why a claim of yours is true, or an argument of yours is valid, and you say, because I was pronounced dead for a weekend, you have not given me a reason. Your claims are as sound or unsound as they were before. Believers argue that if one were to invent a story, you wouldn't choose women to be the ones to discover Jesus' empty tomb. At the time, women weren't seen as reliable sources of information, so if you were just making it all up, why wouldn't you just have men be the ones to discover Jesus' empty tomb? Well, one possibility is that the story was made up by women, but there's a bigger problem with the story. The Gospels contradict each other in crucial ways in their different tellings of the women discovering the empty tomb. We logically can't take the story at its word, like apologists want, if the stories are making mutually incompatible claims. And just to go over this again, in John's Gospel, Mary went alone to the tomb. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Mary goes with other women. In Mark, the women didn't tell anyone what they saw. In the three other Gospels, they did tell people what they saw. Was the stone rolled away before they arrived or not? Well, it depends on which Gospel you read. There are too many discrepancies in the Gospels regarding the story of the women or woman at the tomb to take it seriously as historically inerrant, let alone the perfect word of God. Why would we have an argument about why women were the ones to discover the tomb if your own story is internally contradictory in unreconcilable ways? These are another set of contradictions that can't be explained away by the car crash analogy. Also, in his book How Jesus Became God, Bart Ehrman pointed out that crucifixion victims were not allowed to have a burial, almost without exception. Why was Jesus buried in a tomb in the first place when our sources regarding crucifixion suggest that victims were denied burial as part of the punishment? Part of the punishment of crucifixion was the denial of a proper burial, since a good burial was deeply important to these superstitious inhabitants of the Middle East 2,000 years ago. Part of the horror of crucifixion was the body left on display on the cross for all to see, unburied. Christians have to answer the question, which I have never heard addressed, why was Jesus the exception to this rule? We have to consider the possibility, since the default position according to historical records appears to be the denial of any burial. Not only did Jesus never walk out of his tomb, but he was probably never even buried in the first place. I really like the story of Doubting Thomas because I think it tips the hand of the New Testament authors a little more than believers seem to realize. Thomas is skeptical of Jesus' resurrection, and when Jesus appears, he still isn't quite convinced, so he asks for direct sensory evidence. Then the skeptic is totally convinced, and Jesus says, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." So the moral of the story is, don't be skeptical. You'll be more blessed if you're not. Don't be skeptical is another terrible idea from the New Testament that should have made it into last week's episode. But isn't it convenient that there's a story shaming someone who had the bad taste to ask for evidence? If you think of these stories as memes, memes being the cultural analog to genes, something like the story of Doubting Thomas will help the ideas propagate. Having a story where an initially skeptical person is convinced is good, but it's even better if Jesus himself says that you're more blessed if you're not skeptical in the first place. Imagine how quickly a religion would die out if it actually encouraged its followers to be skeptical. The religions that explicitly repudiate skepticism will fare much better than the ones that don't. Properties like these can help a meme spread. So if you're God, is this how you would put together your perfect book? Copies of contradictory manuscripts written anonymously by non-eyewitnesses decades after the events in languages that very few people would end up speaking? If you're God and you're trying to make sure the most important event in human history is preserved, why wouldn't you make sure that a single original manuscript survived? You also could have made sure that there were thousands of independent, contemporaneous eyewitnesses and preserved all of their original manuscripts.
Your position, to the extent that I understand it, because I haven't got a kind of a straight answer yet, is one where there is a God who has an important message for mankind, and somehow he only reveals it to certain individuals who then write this down, and thousands of years after this initial revelation, we have to rely on copies of translations of copies by anonymous authors with no originals, and a textual testimony to a miracle, for example, the loaves and fishes, there's no amount of reports, anecdotal testimonial reports, that could be sufficient to justify believing that this event actually happened as reported. No amount. And anything that would qualify as a god would clearly understand this, and if it wanted to convey this information to people in a way that was believable, would not be relying on text to do so. And this, for me, is the nail in the coffin for Christianity.
We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we are talking about human sacrifice. The idea that ritual human sacrifice is a good way to solve problems is obviously a relic from our ancestors. We might as well be talking about throwing virgins into volcanoes. And somehow, in the 21st century, hundreds of millions of people will be gathering next week to celebrate and sing songs and nod along solemnly to a sermon, all in observance of a ritual human sacrifice. The narrative Christians are trying to sell isn't just morally absurd, it's also just absurd. In the Christian mythology, God is omnipotent. He makes the rules. So why does God need to offer a human sacrifice to himself to stop himself from sending us to hell? Why did he even make hell? Why did Jesus have to take on our sins for us to be saved from it? Is God bound by some laws that he's subject to? This story sounds a lot more like it was imagined by our primitive, desert-wandering, animal-sacrificing ancestors, more than it's the plan or the behavior of an omnipotent and omniscient God.
Suppose you were walking by my house one day. You've been walking by for a long time. And I were to go up on the porch and say, "Hey, stop, I've got some good news. Good news for you people. Stop, stop, stop. You don't have to go down in my basement. This is great news. You've been walking by all this time. You've been ignoring me, and I deserve to be recognized and honored. And you've been ignoring me, and it's made me so angry and so mad, and I just get so horribly mad. So I built this torture chamber down in the basement. But you don't have to go down there. I sent my son down there. And it was gruesome, I tell you, it was really horrible, but that satisfied my anger. And now, his blood was shed, and now you're free. You don't have to go down. All you have to do, come on up here. Just come up and tell my son that you love him and hug him, and then you can move in with us. We'll live up in the attic, and you can tell me how great I am. You can just tell me how much you love me, and we'll do that. Won't that be great? So would you keep walking?
On a hill far away stood an old rugged cross, the emblem of suffering and shame. But I love that old cross where the dearest and best for a world of lost sinners was slain.
That's all I have for you today. I have to thank my Hall of Fame patron, Peach Machine. Thank you, and thanks to all my patrons who make this show possible. And you can support this show on a per-episode basis at patreon.com/counter, where you can earn early access to every episode and access to bonus episodes. If you don't have the money to support on Patreon, but you still want to make the suffering of Christ all for nothing, you can like us on our social media, leave a 5-star review, or tell your friends about the podcast. My sources for this episode are linked in the show notes. Our theme music was written and performed by the band Wailers. The song is called Magic Tricks and was used with permission. Thank you for joining me today. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.